Coming up on Tech Nation, the explosion of medical information and how it could work for us in the future. I speak with Dr. Eric Schott, the Dean of Precision Medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai and the founder and CEO of Semaphore. Then on Tech Nation Health, a vaccine to treat Alzheimer's and potentially prevent it. Dr. A.J. Verma from United Neuroscience tells us about how and why it might work. Then Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft tells us about the age wave. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's Take 5 with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Remember Santa Claus and his amazing superpowers? I can't dependably sing on key, so I'll just repeat the lyric. He knows when you are sleeping. He knows when you're awake. Who knew that this superpower would become reality in wristband fitness trackers and smartwatches that you can wear every day? Of course, there's been an unexpected twist. All manner of crimes have been solved thanks to these gadgets. One man asserted his wife had just been killed by home intruders. Unfortunately, her Fitbit showed she had died an hour earlier. And then there's the San Jose man who claimed he'd left his stepdaughter's home well before she was discovered slain. While he accurately told the police when he arrived, he fudged a bit about when he left. Surveillance cameras kept him there another 10 minutes. And her Fitbit? Well, during that extended period, her Fitbit marked a sharp rise in heart rate and then a slowing until minutes later no heartbeat registered at all. 5 minutes after that, he walked out her front door. One technology is tough to argue with. Two technologies, well, good luck with that. This made me think about a simple fact of technology. Over time, desirable technologies often merge together. If a person wears both a fitness tracker and a smartwatch, or a very high-end smartwatch by itself, you get the integrated benefit of the state of your physical body and your geographic location, which in turn leads me in still another direction. These crime stories all required the person to remember to strap on their gadgets. And what else does smarter, faster, cheaper often produce? You know it. Smaller, then tiny, then minuscule. So let's project forward. Let's say we embedded a combined fitness tracker and GPS in our bodies, or as I like to think about it, in my body. While I'm not all that thrilled about the idea of anyone or anything tracking me around, there are upsides. Having a health event, such as a heart attack or a stroke or you name it, knowing that it is happening and exactly where you are in the world can mean the difference between life and death, and you don't need to remember to strap it on. It seems everyone I know travels far and wide. Sometimes they're in remote and unfamiliar places, and sometimes alone in hotel rooms in cities with the best medical facilities. And then there are those who live alone, happily, but alone. Anyone can experience an unexpected event at any age, and when you're alone, who would know? While the technologies to monitor health status are coming fast and furious, many of them require you to strap them on, and that's when we come face to face with human frailty. In a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine, 2,300 heart patients were studied, and two-thirds were fitted with a vest to be worn underneath clothing. It contained a heart defibrillator, ready to shock their hearts back into regular beating. Over the three-month study period, average use went from 18 hours a day to 12 hours a day. At the end, half of the patients were no longer using the vest. It's not surprising, is it? We humans aren't very good at doing anything every day, all the time. So we may be moving from the idea that freedom means freedom from technology to freedom means trusted embedded technology 24/7. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, what happens to all that medical data we've accumulated over time and will be accumulating from here on out? I speak with Dr. Eric Schott, the Dean of Precision Medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai and the founder and CEO of Semaphore. Then on Tech Nation Health, work on a vaccine to treat and potentially prevent Alzheimer's. Dr. A.J. Verma from United Neuroscience talks about their efforts, and Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft tells us about the age wave. It's about to break. Over our lives, we've all had plenty of blood tests, x-rays, now genetic tests, and more. With technology, the information about our health status is growing quickly. I asked Eric Schott, the founder and CEO of Semaphore, what does that growth of information mean?
The growth of information means, you know, first of all, the digital universe of data has grown at with such speed, you know, that we're now up to, you know, a zettabyte of data, soon to be a yottabyte of data, which is so unimaginably
large.
You
mean Yoda, like Yoda in Star Wars?
Yeah, like Yoda in Star Wars. I had to look that one up because I had no idea what came
forget after gigabyte, yeah.
Right, forget giga, you know, tera, petabytes. And what you saw in the field of medicine in particular is we went from petabytes to zettabytes, skipped right over exabytes. Like nobody even heard of that. But so it's such data built up around you. You mentioned some of the sources, but think about the iPhone or other smart device you carry with you and the GPS coordinates. And that those GPS coordinates are sampled at high frequency over time, and they link into geographic information systems that have things like what's the temperature and the pollen counts and the traffic flow and the electricity usage and on and on and on, just these really holistic profiles that can be built up around you and interpret, you know, what's happening in the environment that you're existing in and how might it explain some of the things you have going on with you, whether it's I feel tired all the time or I'm having allergy problems or I even have abnormal test results that my physician can now be more and more accurately predicted, you know, from this data that can be built up around you. So it means both better insights into what's happening with you and better ability to predict, but it also means removal of any kind of privacy because all of this data built up around you uniquely identifies you. Any high-dimensional sets of data that exist around you are very, very specific to you.
You're the only one in this body walking around this way.
Your pattern of your walking speed, your gait, what stores you visit, what foods you
how
purchase.
How you use your phone, your smartphone.
How you use your phone, how
somebody
fast
else
you are.
Will, if you gave access to somebody else to use your phone or you gave it to your son saying, you know, I don't need this anymore, fella, immediately it would be very simple to analyze that it is not you using that phone.
You got it.
It is somebody else.
You got it. Yeah. So it's you know, definitely a brave new world of sorts where we don't either have our heads around, you know, what all can this data
How do
predict?
You sleep at night, Eric? I just want to know.
Yeah,
this is what you think about all of this data.
You kind of get over it because if you think about, like, one of my, like, heads up I like to talk about are that, you know, DNA sequencing, we like to think of our DNA as very private, personal information because it gets to the depths of who we are and what made us. Who we are, But the technology moving so fast that, you know, maybe 10 years time, it'll be as easy to sequence your DNA as it is to take a photograph. And, you know, when that happens, any kind of expectation of privacy you have is kind of gone. And we've experienced this before. So think of photographs of your face. Like, I don't necessarily like the way I look, and I would like to hide.
Talk to the Kardashians.
Things, right? But you don't have a choice. Like, the courts have ruled, like, you're out in public. People can take your picture. There's nothing you can do to hide it. So I think as we get more comfortable with all this big information around us, just like we have with photographs, we'll just grow more comfortable that, you know, this data is easier for people to see now, just like a picture. It's going to get used for a myriad of purposes, and the hope is that we'll benefit.
If you've ever been in an international airport where you suddenly you're getting off your plane, you're walking, and then, okay, here is the baggage claim, and you actually end up sort of single file through a number of places in parallel, and you realize you go through, they've taken your picture.
Yeah.
And before you get to your luggage, which could be right there, they've already said, who is this person?
I have a better one for you. In Tokyo, as you're walking down the sidewalk in the shopping districts, of course, they're taking your picture as well. They're interpreting your age, your sex, how you're dressed. And the ads you see as you walk down the sidewalk are a function of what they assess from you further up the sidewalk. So you're actually in real time being presented with ads as you're walking down the business district based on the photographs that were taken of you, you know, 30 seconds ago. Pretty amazing.
If there was room for, like, 30 seconds of silence on air with that, people thinking that we really, right. It would be time now. It would be time now. But your Semaphore Genomics, obviously, you're working a lot around the area of what's in our gene and our genome and how that probably affects healthcare.
Absolutely. You know, the changes in your DNA, both the constellation of changes you were born with that your parents gave to you as part of
looming larger every day.
Right. But also mutations you incur through environmental exposures to, you know, toxins and sun and so on, that those, you know, changes in your DNA are a very big determinant of your health, your wellness, your intelligence, your personality, and all the way to all the different kinds of disease risk. But it's very, very complicated. Because there's not like one change in your DNA that makes you smart or makes you very athletic. It's thousands and thousands of changes and interacting in complex ways with the environment. So we think a lot about how do we integrate all the information we know about the DNA with all the information we know about your health and the environment in which you live in. And we try to build sort of, you know, almost think of like climate, you know, like climate models or quantitative finance or in theoretical physics. Like we're trying to build these predictive models based on all of those huge number of variables of information to see can we better predict, you know, sort of your health course trajectories.
So are your ultimate clients individuals?
Yeah, both individual patients, because we can provide more meaningful insights and guidance around whatever health course trajectory they're on, but also physician, you know, to bear all the actionable guidance we can give, you know, to physician around, you know, treatment choices or subtypes of disease and so on. We can provide that information to physicians to help better diagnose and treat the patients.
Okay, so let's say we'll just start with the physicians because they're treating people. Sometimes, frankly, they feel very isolated. You know,
yes.
They're trying to treat this, but now they've got one that is a little off the charts. You know, and they're trying to consult with friends. They're trying to
Google it
like you do, and they need more information. That information, is that general or is that specific to their patient?
It's both, and it's a great point of, you know, so if, remember I said zettabyte worth of data in the digital universe, soon to be a yottabyte. A physician, no human, has the ability to hold all of what that information says in their head. Like we need mathematical models, representations of our knowledge and understanding that we can query with computers. That's the whole success of a Google, a search engine. You can, you know, type it in and you get lots of meaningful stuff back. But In this case, it's sort of both a general, like what are the underpinnings of human diseases, what tissues are affected, what are the molecular makeup of that, and so on. But then very highly personalized, because there may be, take Alzheimer's disease or heart disease, there may be 100 different, you know, causes or pathways at play that may be affected in you that lead to your heart disease, but completely different ones that affect another person in the same disease, but a different path, a different cause. So how you're treated then matters. What molecularly inside of you has been disrupted, and we have to fix that disruption. Well, you have to know what that is. So that's a very personalized, like you may have a specific cause, you know, that's very unique to you that isn't in the standard of care population that a physician sees. And a physician won't know that because they don't have that information. So they're just making a decision based on the population that they know. So it is about ultimately personalizing in a precise way, where the precision medicine comes from, is we want to personalize in a way that's highly accurate, is taking all the information into account and giving, again, the most actionable guidance on what you should do to, you know, correct the problem.
So, of course, then we're talking about an increased or a higher level of partnership between the patient and the doctor. You know, the doctor needs the data from the patient to start working through that.
Yeah. Yeah, you got it. And that was one of the, you know, early pilots we did that really sold me on, you know, that this partnership is critical. As we, you know, developed an asthma app, we were one of the first institutions to develop on top of HealthKit research kit with Apple. And we focused on asthma, and it was all about how do we engage patient in their normal life journey with asthma to learn more about the specifics of their condition. So if you think of, you know, the number of times you go even to a doctor with asthma, maybe once or twice or three times a year. And in that visit, you talk to the doctor maybe for 5 minutes. Like, what can the doctor possibly learn in that short period of time? You know, very little, unless you have biomarkers that are way outside the norm. Then they can flag that. So what we did is said, okay, let's engage patient electronically. We'll consent them in ways that allows us to collect information on them. We'll provide that information back to them. And what it allowed us to do was to get how many exacerbations did you have over the last month? What were the causes of those exacerbations? How many times did you puff on your maintenance inhaler, on your rescue inhaler? When you had an exacerbation, what was the temperature, the pollen counts, the pollution levels? What were your activity levels? What was your sleep like? So you now have this really longitudinal, high density, high dimensional characterization of what's going on in that patient, that when we started presenting that back to a physician in the form of a dashboard, so that when the patient goes to the physician, they show this dashboard of everything that's been happening with their condition over the last, since their last visit, and the physician in 15 seconds can see, holy cow, you've had 20 exacerbations when the temperature or pollen counts were like this and your maintenance inhaler wasn't working. Like, you should have come in. In fact, they were so impressed by that. They said, is there any way you can start pushing this up into the medical record so I don't have to wait for that patient to come in for their next visit? I can reach out to them because I know if they puffed 10 times on their inhaler in a day, they need to come see me, like something's wrong. So it is, it's using technology, you know, these advanced smart devices and the more engaging tools to help bring physician and patient closer together and to help them both leverage the data that can be aggregated on an individual to make more informed decisions.
Truly next-gen healthcare.
Next-gen healthcare, for sure.
You know, I have to say that this has to do with when things aren't right. This isn't like if everything's good and you're going along and everything's fine, just whatever has been collected about you, we just don't want to lose it because it may become relevant later. But you don't need to move through this integrated data cloud all the time if everything's fine.
Well, it's one of the things we hope to change is this idea in medicine today. We treat diseases as very black and white. It's either you're sick or you're not sick. And that, as we know, is not true, right? Diseases occur on a continuum, a spectrum, and you're either always moving towards that state or you're in a well state and you're able to resist getting those diseases. But the only way you can track something like that is to not be coming in an acute state of distress.
Oh, rats, I knew you were going to say that.
You know? I knew it. So even when you think you're well, like just, again, even with well individuals, if you can look at information around those well individuals and map out what trajectory are you really on? Are you on a trajectory that's going to resist all of these common diseases that plague a lot of us? Or are you on a trajectory that's going to be catastrophic in 5 years' time? Like if you do not bounce off that path, you're going to have lots of problems. Well, both the well individuals want to know, not only am I on a good path, but how do I stay on that path? Like what are the right kinds of interventions? Like what are the right kinds of foods or exercises or what drugs shouldn't I take because I'm more sensitive? I'm going to have an adverse event. Like all of that information can be leveraged to say, how do you maintain a more well, more robust state of wellness? So I think it applies to both. Like they're all in this continuum. And the push has to be, how do we get more probabilistic in our understanding of these diseases, not black and white, binary, as if you just one day had a heart attack and nobody saw that coming. You know, we know that's not true.
One event that happens, and it's an event over months, one event that happens to many women and sometimes multiple times in the course of their lives is pregnancy. And at the moment you become pregnant, everything changes. You got baby on board.
And we really start that journey before you're pregnant. And that's everything from assessing your current state of wellness. So what are you at risk of even before you become pregnant, of complications that can happen in pregnancy? So think gestational diabetes, preeclampsia, preterm birth, perinatal depression. All sorts of things can happen during your pregnancy. And if you better understand that risk at the beginning, you can better manage that journey through its course. We also start with the genetics. Like what are you, as a mom and your reproductive health partner, what are you at high risk of passing on to your offspring that would be catastrophic? So think of things like Tay-Sachs disease or cystic fibrosis, you know, these kinds of diseases that if you knew you were at high risk, you would, maybe do in vitro fertilization.
Yeah.
You would say, okay, I'm going to have these embryos fertilized and I'm going to pick ones that aren't going to pass this disease on. Once you're pregnant, there's non-invasive prenatal testing that we do. And again, our whole aim is, you know, can we help the woman kind of manage that journey, the information around her, and again, provide better insights into the risks that she'll be exposed to through that course. And then even once the baby's born, you know, you have depression-related issues that can arise, and there are even issues within the unborn child or the newly born child. So think of rare disorders that sometimes don't manifest until you're one or two. If you could detect those at birth, there's some conditions where if you knew them at birth, you could give an intervention that would lead to a normal life. If they go 1 to 2 years when it clinically manifests, you've lost 20 IQ points and you're never getting those points back. Like, so just being able to test at birth to say, you know, does my child have any condition that can be treated from day one? Like those are the sorts of things that this technology is bringing to bear on that pregnancy journey.
Let's say we have a patient all signed up, really wants to do this. Are we seeing pushback from doctors?
Absolutely. So it's a mix today. Some of the things like the carrier screening I mentioned at the beginning, which you should be getting before you're becoming pregnant, and the non-invasive prenatal testing, those are kind of standard of care. They very rapidly became standard of care. You know, probably 3 or 4 years ago, the standard of care for carrier screening was like 4 to 8 diseases that the professional bodies recommended. Today we're testing for hundreds, you know, like it's moved really fast. But that's become rapidly standard of care because it's had such a positive impact on reproductive health choices. But things like newborn screening definitely push back on, you know, a controversy around, you know, what are the advantages and disadvantages? Like, what are the risks that somebody gets in having that information generated? If they're tested for a condition where you don't know exactly what to do, it creates anxiety, it creates stress. You know, is that a good thing or a bad thing? And so there's lots of studies we and others are running to try to help figure out. But what I feel like is we can't have our head in the sand and pretend like this isn't happening. Like we have to engage, you know, individuals in studies. We have to engage broader societies, legislators, regulatory bodies. Like we all have to kind of figure this out together. But you're not going to stop it. Like it's you mentioned 23andMe ancestry. Like there are these consumer-facing, direct-to-consumer efforts where, you know, there's no regulatory body involved. It's, you know, you as consumer can decide you want that information and you can submit that up to various web pages and they'll give you interpretations. Like we have to, like, that wave's here and it's, you have to figure out how to ride it or maybe help guide it. That's how we view it. And the pushback we get is, okay, well, let's work with you. Let's carry out the right kind of study, or let's restrict what we report back to only things where we can do something about it. So we're not going to test you for, are you at high risk of developing early onset Alzheimer's? Because as a baby, what are you going to do about that information? But if you have a G6PD deficiency, knowing that at birth, all you have to do is change your diet and you won't get any of the clinical effects from that deficiency. Like something that simple, it's not tested for in newborn screening panels at the state level. Like, why wouldn't you want to know that information? So a lot of it is giving actionable information to the physician where they know what to do and they can guide the patient on what they can do.
Well, Eric, I could talk to you for about 10 years. We don't have that kind of time.
I'm sorry if I was rambling on.
No, so. I was like, oh, yeah, I'm catching it. I'm catching what you're saying here. But what we're looking at here is a whole tsunami of information.
Tsunami is the right word.
And how it interrelates and how we're supposed to relate to it and what we can do and all of that. It's all coming at us. You know, I've been saying it's like it's coming at us, but it's finally here.
It's here.
It's really here. So I do hope you'll come back and talk to us again and keep us updated.
Well, thank you.
Eric Schott is the founder and CEO of Semaphore. More information is available at semaphore.com. That's S-E-M-A, Sema, and the number 4, semaphore.com. You're listening to Tech Nation. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Tech Nation Health are available at NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Tech Nation Health, Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft talks about the age wave. What does it mean and who's riding it? Stay with us.
Oh,
Welcome to Tech Nation Health, reimagining the future of health and healthcare with the emergence of new technologies and breakthrough science. We all have the expectation that modern medicine will continue to march forward, addressing the conditions we face at every age, now and in the future. And why not? By gathering statistics from the years 2000 through 2014, the CDC found that people were living longer because major challenges attributed to aging are being successfully addressed. They're all familiar to you: stroke, heart attack, pneumonia, and the flu. What used to be life-threatening can now be faced down with medical care, both in the moment and ongoing. One simple example? Over 200,000 Americans are living full lives with heart pacemakers. It's simply become a routine matter of life. But not all medical conditions associated with aging have had such success. The CDC also tells us that 5 million Americans are living with Alzheimer's disease. Today we'll look at an approach to treating Alzheimer's in an effort not simply intended to be curative, but potentially preventative. Also unusual, it's a vaccine. Then, to put it all in context, Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft will tell us about a new term, the age wave. What does that mean, and what do we know? Nearly everyone who listens to this interview has been vaccinated, one way or another, usually starting when we're very young. But over all that time, it's important to know that our traditional idea of vaccines has been changing. I asked Dr. A.J. Verma, the Chief Medical Officer of United Neuroscience, what are vaccines today?
Great question. I think everybody is familiar with our, you know, granddad's vaccine, if you will, the old, you know, either active viruses or inactivated viruses or little bits of them. You know, these days, we really look at this as immunotherapy, as engineered immunotherapy, where we can
jumping
target.
Jumping up your immune system.
Yep. But you got to do that carefully. The immune system has many sides to it that can do good as well as harm. And obviously, when you're trying to fight off a virus or a cancer, you want to, you know, beat the heck out of it and throw all you got at it. But it may be possible to use the vaccine approach to treat a whole host of other diseases that are inside you. Bad pathologies that creep up as we age, as we, you know, get older and different systems wear down. But you have to be much more gentle with the immune system when you go after those, because you don't want all the friendly fire. You don't want the damage that the immune system might do to a virus to happen to a normal organ. So that's been the trick, is how to get vaccines to be so controllable.
Slow movers.
Well, it could be slow or just the right movers.
Right.
The immune system has many arms to it. There are antibodies. There are, you know, different types of cells we activate. Now we know enough about them to just do this arm and not that arm. That hasn't been possible before. And I think that's been the big breakthrough that United Neuroscience is trying to capitalize on. We have a technology that's been well worked out in animal health. So that's a big advantage for us. We know it's safe. We know it's effective. It can treat not only viral infections in animal applications, but also some endogenous disorders.
Now, what's endogenous?
Endogenous means something inside you already. A virus comes and infects you from the outside. Certain things in your body build up that are endogenously, high cholesterol levels that will eventually give you some heart problems unless you check them. Maybe some aggregated, misfolded proteins that your body doesn't clear out. If they build up over time, they may actually damage brain cells. You may have too much of a pain hormone that's causing you migraines all the time. If we can just lower it gently with an antibody, which is happening right now, actually. There's a bunch of antibodies about to be approved for that. You know, why can't we do that with a vaccine? Have you make your own antibody? It's just been, how do we control that and get it right and turn this practice into a real drug that can be used safely, you know, reversibly? That's what I find exciting. It's a huge challenge, but I think we're there, actually, from all the learnings we've had in other areas.
Now, you're United Neuroscience. You're not focusing on cholesterol. You're focusing on the brain.
Yes. Yes. You know, we've done really well, I think, actually, in medicine over the last 100 years. If you look at where we are with cancer, we're actually making some significant progress. Heart disease, we're all living longer. We've wiped out a lot of infections. we haven't taken care of some problems with the brain. And in a way, all those other advances are compounding the problem that we have left with the brain, because now people are living to an older age where they will get more Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. So unless we deal with these problems, you know, this will be a major calamity. Alzheimer's, you know, itself is so prevalent now. If you're over 65, you have about a 1 in 10, maybe 1 in 8 chance of getting Alzheimer's. If you're over 85, it's close to like 1 out of 2 or 1 out of 3.
And you better get to work.
Exactly. And like, this is our generation. This is our problem.
Baby boom generation is just coming right up on those numbers.
We've got to deal with this. And I think in general, neuro diseases, this is the age that we address them. 1 out of 6 people in the world have some kind of neuro problem. And that's what makes us human, is our brain. So this is probably the biggest challenge I think we have in this century. If we don't do something about it, just Alzheimer's alone, you know, many world economies will be crippled by the middle of the century, because much of the third world is experiencing the same benefits that the Western world went through in like the 50s and 60s, where we have a lot more nutrition and, you know, public health. So in countries like India and China, people are living much longer. So they're going to have a massive explosion of, you know, Alzheimer's and some of these neurodegenerative diseases. So we have to do something about this. There's no other choice.
Now, what are you working on for your first objective?
Well, we are fortunate in that we have a platform technology. We have a way to...
That means it can be used in many different ways.
That's correct. That means we can instruct the body to make defenses against a variety of different targets. So we can choose those targets. We can be very forward-looking and be imaginative, or we can take lessons from what others are doing in the field. What looks like it's working? Where are we making a dent? Now, can we adopt the advances there to a vaccine platform, which has, you know, a lot of benefits for today? You know, we're living in such a great time for biomedical advances. We have we can replace genes. We can do gene therapy. We can take care of RNA diseases with what we call, you know, RNA drugs, antisense drugs. We have monoclonal antibodies, which are probably the supreme drug right now as far as being very targeted, very efficient. But they come at a big cost. They're not accessible to most of the people that actually need them. And I'm really, you know, excited about the challenge to bring innovations that actually make medicines more pragmatic. You know, we put a supercomputer in everybody's hands now with a
smartphone,
right?
Yeah.
We need to start thinking like that. How can we, you know, get the best minds to innovate to make medicines cheaper, make them more pragmatic, more affordable? We actually want to reach the people that need these medications. And so I'm particularly enamored by the vaccine approach, because that's one medicine that everybody's had, as you said. They work. They're wonderful at preventing disease. They're great to be used in combination therapy. It's just, how do we do it safely to address non-infectious diseases? That's been the challenge.
What's your first target?
Well, our first target, believe it or not, started in animal health. And this platform was worked out by our parent company in agricultural applications. So it's currently used to vaccinate about a quarter of the world's pigs. There's over 3 billion doses that have been sold. And it's mainly used for a viral disease, for foot and mouth disease. If the effects wear off, it can be reversible even, because of the way our platform works. You know, that really excited me. Like, God, if you can regulate a biology reversibly with a vaccine approach, there's no end to what you could do with a vaccine approach. Now, about 20 years ago, this idea of trying to use a vaccine to treat Alzheimer's disease was actually tried. Back then, we didn't know how to control each arm of the immune system, you know, very well. And what was observed was, while the approach worked in animals, it looked promising early on in clinical development, they did run into some safety problems, where the immune response that was unleashed did attack the brain itself. And about 6% of the people had what we call meningoencephalitis. And so the whole effort had to be stopped. Now, mind you, some people, even though they stopped being dosed, did fare pretty well compared to what you might expect. And at autopsy, several of them, you know, showed evidence of amyloid being cleared from the brain. So the idea was that this could work if we could just get around the safety issue. And what our parent company did was figure out how to use a vaccine approach and just activate one arm of the immune system. And it does it by sort of fooling the immune system into thinking you have an infection on board when you really don't. We actually make these little peptides, these little bits of proteins that sort of kind of look like pathogens that all humans are exposed to, whether it's measles or something else. But they're engineered, they're artificial. So your immune system gets tricked. Oh, there's something there that I got to go after and mount a big response. But when they go and interrogate it, there really isn't the organism that it was thinking.
You tricked me there.
Okay?
Yeah.
But in the process, by what we've attached to this construct, we get the immune system to make lots of antibodies against whatever we've attached to this fake immunogen, if you will. And that seems to work. And it seems to be safe. It doesn't launch what we call this cytotoxic T-cell response, which is what is the autoimmunity that you see in multiple sclerosis and lupus and a bunch of other diseases.
So the police got a call. They went out to see, oh, we know these guys. Yeah, don't worry about it. In the meantime, it launched the antibodies.
Right. And because it doesn't really rile up the immune system in a severe way like other vaccines would, we don't leave a permanent memory, meaning this is not like a one and done and lifelong now you have this immunity. So the we activate what's called the B cell arm of the immune system. And when you do that, those B cells proliferate and they die out over time. So after vaccinating someone and getting their antibodies level, if we stop dosing, those levels will come back down over about, 8 months to a year. Now if we boost, we can get it right back up again. So now we can sculpt the response and keep it elevated as long as we want, depending on which disease and what we want to. So it's a drug. And we anticipate, after priming people in their first year, which is really a dose at these are flu shots right in your arm, just like you'd get a muscle flu shot, at baseline, 1 month and 3 months. And then after that, we see our antibody levels rise around 4 months, let's say. And then they gently start to come down. But if we boost people along the way, we can keep it up. And so we're testing various boost dosing frequencies like that. And, so far it seems to be safe. We seem to be able to get good antibodies. We think eventually if we are successful and this becomes a drug, this will probably be like an annual booster. So once a year you just reboost up your levels and you monitor it just like you'd monitor cholesterol or some other biomarker. And hopefully it'll ward off disease. Now, we have to actually prove this in early disease first. But our real hope is that we can do that. It'll be safe and more pragmatic so that we can actually move to prevention.
Now, what are the antibodies doing with respect to Alzheimer's?
Well, it looks like antibodies can neutralize some target that you aim them at. And we're used to them aiming at viruses and toxins and so on. That's what traditional vaccines do. It looks like what we're learning about neurodegeneration is that some normal proteins that do something good in your body your whole life, late in life, in the brain, they tend to misfold and accumulate as little aggregates that for some reason in the old age the brain has a harder time clearing out. Now, as they accumulate, they really these proteins, when I say they become misfolded, imagine a protein like a necklace that then if you scrunch it together, it can have different shapes and show different sides of it. Some of the parts of the protein that are being shown in these aggregates are new. They're not there throughout your life. So I actually look at them as sort of neoantigens, meaning it's something new that your body never saw before. So you might expect your immune system to go and take care of it.
Yeah.
Because that's actually what your immune system does when it sees things like that. But mind you, this is happening in a time when you're aging. Your immune system's weakening a bit. And so maybe it doesn't do so well in some people, and maybe it does in other people. It could be that the immune system's actually taking care of this all the time in those people that don't get Alzheimer's. People forget that most people don't get Alzheimer's. And so what can we learn from them to help, the less fortunate? Now, it turns out that the leading antibody in the field is something called aducanumab, being developed by Biogen and Neurimmune. That actually comes from an individual that somehow happened to have high levels of antibodies endogenously.
And did not have Alzheimer's.
We don't know the identity of the subject, but I think this is a healthy subject that did very well. That's why the person was studied, But lo and behold, they happen to have high levels of these antibodies. So that's the source of the drug, actually. It was actually engineered from such a person.
This is a Henrietta Lacks story.
It's fascinating.
Only it's an antibody here.
Yes. So it's a wonderful piece of science. But it makes you wonder, hey, is this happening all the time? You know, is your body immunizing itself against these diseases? And that's why some people don't get ill. Now, mind you, most of the vaccinations we get in life are not from a vaccine that we get at the doctors. It's just from getting the flu or the cold or experiences in life. We're getting vaccinated all the time from the stuff that we're exposed to.
And our immune system's learning.
Right. And so really, in a snapshot, we're trying to teach the immune system how to learn better with a vaccine. That's really what vaccines do. They prepare you. They get you ready for the real war that's, you know, that you have to fight. And so that's, in a nutshell, our approach. We think that these misfolded proteins are something that you should get rid of in late life, and we can train the immune system to do it. Now, is it just one bad thing? You know, everybody's focusing on beta amyloid. It's clear that that's a target from the genetics. Those people that happen to have certain mutations will get Alzheimer's if they have those particular mutations. But that may be the only thing that may be what kicks off the whole, you know, fire. That may be the kindling, basically. But later on in disease, there may be other pathologies. Tau aggregation has been identified as another one. Neuroinflammation. So we may need to treat multiple targets. And that's something we're very excited about at United Neuroscience, because we're working on combination therapies against multiple misfolded proteins, against not only amyloid, but alpha-synuclein, tau. So we have a combo vaccine with all three, for example. It's like the adult MMR. So imagine when you're 45, you know, getting a combo
vaccine. Vaccinated again. We thought we were done when we were kids.
Yep. And then that keeps you, you know, when you were kids, it was against these viruses and exogenous things. But later in life, maybe there's endogenous things that we can vaccinate against. So we were excited about this approach.
Well, AJ, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you come back and talk to us again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. A.J. Verma is the Chief Medical Officer of United Neuroscience. More information is available at unitedneuroscience.com. Whether it's Alzheimer's or any number of diseases and conditions, I've started hearing a new term, the age wave. I asked Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft, what does that mean?
Yeah, I think the term age wave was coined by my friend Ken Dykewald, who is sort of an expert at looking at the lens of aging, where it is and where it's heading and its implications. And to the point of baby boomers are now reaching age 65 and beyond. I think it's about a quarter have already reached it, and many more are getting to that point. And Ken often makes the point that of those over age 65 who've ever lived to over 65, two-thirds are alive today. And that is only growing, not necessarily exponentially, but
they didn't make 65.
Exactly. And many who are 65 don't think of themselves as old. That might used to have been the old number, because it was sort of picked out in the 1880s by Bismarck as sort of the age for actuarial tables when folks would start to get pensions. But at that point in the 1880s, you know, the average life expectancy was still, you know, mid-40s. So we need to, potentially, as technology evolves, our ability to age smarter and live better, you know, what is old? Is that just a measure of months on a calendar or parts of our biology? And then what are the implications as we have this age wave coming in terms of the marketplace, society, how we service and treat the older population and connect them to the younger? Lots of implications there as our society gets older.
Well, it seems to me if they're living longer and longer and longer, we don't have a lot of scientific data for a whole big group of people that live that long. Is that true?
Well, it takes a long time to do the clinical trials.
Yeah, and then you keep losing people.
And
that
we
was
don't...
a bad joke.
Sure. And even in medical school, you know, where I went at Stanford and most places, there's very little focus on, let's say, gerontology, the study or the care of the aged, when most of our medical dollars is focused on the last few years of life. In fact, there's probably a shortage of gerontologists, and most internists are having to focus on that population. So we have a real unmet need, and that doesn't just come to the area of care, remembering that many of the diseases that we're spending our time and money on are diseases of aging. When folks only lived to 40, they didn't get dementia or heart disease or advanced type 2 diabetes. So we end up in an era of aged diseases. and we need new ways to approach them. We have a very youth-focused society, when in fact the largest market are folks over, let's say, age 50 in terms of buying products. And so there's an opportunity to for entrepreneurs out there to service that population. It's, I think, over 50% of personal care products are bought by folks over 50, over-the-counter drugs, lab tests, surgeries, health club memberships. And it can't just be...
Over 50?
Yeah.
And these are baby boomers.
Baby boomers are...
I'm sorry, they're part of the age wave.
Not babies anymore.
Yeah.
but I think that means there's opportunities to think about not just sort of going to the gym, staying healthy, staying on top of medications, but thinking about how do we design our homes and our society to let folks, quote-unquote, age in place? No one wants our parent or ourselves to end up in a, quote-unquote, traditional nursing home. How can we use everything from the power of the Internet of Things and the ability to connect and Skype with your grandmother or a sensor in the mattress or in the coffee machine to tell what activities are happening in the home to be proactive? Wearable devices we've talked about on the show can track your steps, but now can be used to predict who's likely to have a fall in the next few months. So we can use both the integration of data and new services to keep folks aging in place, maybe helping them with their robots to do their laundry or pick up their socks.
I need that right now.
But also to lend that social connection. Many folks get more socially isolated, and social isolation can be as dangerous as a two-pack-a-day smoking habit in terms of health outcomes. So lots of opportunity for entrepreneurs and services from medical and hospital and social to get out of the bucket of just let's market to the young.
And I have to say, I like the orientation of what are the things that we can do which will better the lives of those, not just worry about could they be unhealthy? Do we have something to fix them? Do we have a drug, a treatment, surgery, whatever? But given everything else, what can we do to make their lives more enjoyable and all the things that make life worth living?
And meaningful and being connected to friends and family. We also, with the age wave, have an increasing and very scary increasing incidence of Alzheimer's and memory issues. And that's something, whether you're Ronald Reagan or Margaret Thatcher, who had incredible medical care, still developed. So it's pretty indiscriminate. And there, of course, there's a lot of new work focusing on hopefully new ways to pick it up early, maybe even with early diagnostics, do interventions like taking a statin for the brain or understanding which markers beyond our genealogy impact risk for memory issues like Alzheimer's, and then potentially provide new services. We're seeing here in San Francisco a company called Honor, which is a bit of I like to think of it as an Uber for home care. Many folks have issues taking care of their older family members. Now there are platforms like that one that can enable you to find caregivers. Others are being developed in the United Kingdom to, when they bring a caregiver in the home, to collect data in new ways, their activities of daily living, mental states, to, again, be proactive and pick up a problem early or to bring resources to that older person's home to meet their needs. And we've talked about Google Maps and ways for our general health, but we all want to have our sort of own healthcare concierge. We all may age at different rates and have different issues, from sore joints to memory issues to a whole host of elements. We need to individualize our care and bring it to the Uberization of health and aging. In fact, Uber themselves has done pilots where you can press a button on the app and bring a nurse to give you a vaccine. We're seeing Uber and Lyft now provide services to bring anybody who has difficulty getting to a clinic, and many older individuals may have trouble driving. So this ability to connect dots and for entrepreneurs and systems to provide services to older populations, I think, is going to continue to explode. And now, even with some of the platforms, you don't need to have a smartphone. You can use your old dial-up phone, rotary phone, to call an Uber, Lyft to get you to your clinic or to the grocery store.
Well, for anybody who lives alone, there's always this problem of you're living alone. Nobody notices that you're declining or that you fell or and hit your head so you can't get up. There are many, many times when you're really, truly alone. So it does help for the age wave, but it helps for anyone in a situation where nobody might find them. And we've lots of instances where it could be very good to have that kind of technology.
And no one wants to be an Inspector Gadget and have to have lots of devices in a censored home that requires a PhD in electrical engineering to set up. What's getting interesting now is our consumer devices, our smartwatches, can potentially tell when someone's had a fall and call their grandchild. Or Wi-Fi has been re-engineered by MIT professors and teams to pick up vital signs and sleep patterns. So we could see if someone has a fall or has changes in behavior that, again, can enable someone who's isolated or alone to get help or bring help when they don't even know they need it.
And it's okay that I sit in my red chair with the ottoman and watch TV for a really long time. I'm just doing a marathon on.
Binge watching is good, but.
Binge watching. I'm not ill. So I have to program that in.
One last element that's certainly often associated with an older population is sometimes over-medication, polypharmacy. About 45% of Americans over 65 are on five or more medications. So it's often difficult to track them, even if you're on top of your game. So many platforms are evolving to be ways to improve adherence, as we call it, whether it's a connected pill bottle that will text you or your doctor or your grandson if you haven't taken your important, let's say, blood thinner, all the way to companies like PillPack that would deliver a set of medications for the day. Amazon recently acquired that company. I'm developing a technology to sort of 3D print your own personalized polypill. I call them IntelliMed. So every day when you wake up, potentially you'd print your combination of medications based on how you slept or your blood pressure or a blood level. So I think there's a lot of unmet needs and a lot of interesting solutions from the medical side to the social side to just the activities of daily living that can help support our aging population. So literally being, if you're 100, we want to focus on health span, not just lifespan. You're able to walk, talk, get around, use the toilet, contribute to society.
Date.
Exactly. There's whole new
There's
new
always
there.
Hope.
Swipe left, swipe right. And think about the implications as we, I've got a 2- and a 4-year-old. They hopefully will live easily past 100. What's the implications for careers, for insurance, for marriage? Many of these things are set to shift. There's lots of debate. Can we really live past 120? Lots of folks working on the biology and the physics and the pharmacy of that, but lots of implications beyond just the age as a number.
Well, I know we'll watch this space, so thanks so much, Daniel.
See you in the future.
Dr. Daniel Kraft is chief correspondent of TechNation Health and the founder and chair of Exponential Medicine. The Exponential Medicine Conference 2018 is scheduled for early November at the Hotel Coronado in San Diego. More information is available at exponentialmedicine.com. For TechNation Health, I'm Moira Gunn.
TechNation and its regular segment, BioTechNation, are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. TechNation and BioTechNation are productions of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Landcor.